From PRI, Public Radio International.
A heavy crack of thunder broke upon the deepest currents of my sleep, so that suddenly I woke as if by force, and with a drowsy gaze, looked about, then stood to get a better sense of where I was, and found myself at the edge of a steep rise that dropped into an abyss.
You're listening to Felicia Rashad reading an excerpt from Dante's Inferno, an epic love story which we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The great epics of literature, from Homer to Beowulf to the Song of Roland and Dante's Divine Comedy, are not short stories. For one thing, they're all rather long. But what they do have in common is that they were intended to be read or sung aloud. First, from the Iliad of Homer, we hear the thrilling final battle to the death between the Greek besieger Achilles and the Trojan defender Hector. This performance is by that heroic actor, Stephen Lang.
So he launched Athena, already poised for action. Down the goddess swept from Olympus' craggy peaks. And swift Achilles kept on coursing Hector, non-stop, as a hound in the mountains starts a fawn from its lair, hunting him down the gorges, down the narrow glens, and the fawn goes to ground, hiding deep in brush, but the hound comes racing fast, nosing him out, until he lands his kill. So, Hector could never throw Achilles off his trail. The swift racer, Achilles, time and again, he'd make a dash for the Dardan gates, trying to rush beneath the rock-built ramparts, hoping men on the heights might save him somehow, raining spears. But time and again Achilles would intercept him quickly, heading him off, forcing him out across the plain, and always sprinting along the city side himself. Endless, as in a dream, when a man can't catch another, fleeing on ahead, and he can never escape nor his rival overtake him. So the one could never run the other down in his speed, nor the other spring away. And how could Hector have fled the fates of death so long? How? Unless one last time, one final time, Apollo had swept in close beside him, driving strength in his legs and knees to race the wind. And brilliant Achilles shook his head at the armies, never letting them hurl their sharp spears at Hector. Someone might snatch the glory. Achilles come in second. But once they reached the springs for the fourth time, then Father Zeus held out his sacred golden scales. In them he placed two fates of death that lays men low, one for Achilles, one for Hector, breaker of horses. And gripping the beam mid-haft, the father raised it high, and down went Hector's day of doom, dragging him down to the strong house of death. And God Apollo left him. Athena rushed to Achilles, her bright eyes gleaming, standing shoulder to shoulder, winging orders now. At last, our hopes run high, my brilliant Achilles. Father Zeus must love you. We'll sweep great glory back to Achaea's fleet. We'll kill this Hector, mad as he is for battle. No way for him to escape us now, no longer. Not even if Phoebus, the distant deadly archer, goes through torments, pleading for Hector's life, groveling over and over before our storming father Zeus. But you hold your ground and catch your breath while I run Hector down and persuade the man to fight you face to face. So Athena commanded, and he obeyed. Rejoicing at heart, Achilles stopped, leaning against his ashen spear shaft barbed in bronze. And Athena left him there, caught up with Hector at once, and taking the build and vibrant voice of Deiphobus, stood shoulder to shoulder with him, winging orders. "Dear brother, how brutally swift Achilles hunts you, coursing you round the city of Priam in all his lethal speed. Come, let us stand our ground together. Beat him back. Deiphobus," Hector, his helmet flashing, called out to her. "Dearest of all my brothers, all these warring years of all the sons of Priam and Hecuba produced, now I'm determined to praise you all the more, you who dared, seeing me in these straits, to venture out from the walls, all for my sake, while the others stay inside and cling to safety." The goddess answered quickly, her eyes blazing, "True, dear brother. How your father and mother both implored me time and again, clutching my knees, and the comrades round me begging me to stay. Such was the fear that broke them, man for man, but the heart within me broke with grief for you. Now headlong on, and fight! No let-up, no lance spared. So now, we'll see if Achilles kills us both and hauls our bloody armor back to the beaked ships, or he goes down in pain beneath your spear." Athena, luring him on with all her immortal cunning. And now, at last, as the two came closing for the kill, it was tall Hector, helmet flashing, who led off. "No more running from you in fear, Achilles, not as before. 3 times I fled around the great city of Priam. I lacked courage then to stand your onslaught. Now my spirit stirs me to meet you face to face. Now, kill or be killed. Come, we'll swear to the gods, the highest witnesses. The gods will oversee our binding pacts. I swear I will never mutilate you, merciless as you are, if Zeus allows me to last it out and tear your life away. But once I've stripped your glorious armor, Achilles, I will give your body back to your loyal comrades. Swear you'll do the same." A swift dark glance, and the headstrong runner answered, "Hector, stop. You. Unforgivable. You. Don't talk to me of pacts. There are no binding oaths between men and lions. Wolves and lambs can enjoy no meeting of the minds. They are all bent on hating each other to the death. So, with you and me, no love between us. No truce till one or the other falls and gluts with blood. Ares, who hacks at men behind his rawhide shield. Come, call up whatever courage you can muster. Life or death. Now prove yourself a spearman, a daring man of war. No more escape for you. Athena will kill you with my spear in just a moment. Now you'll pay it a stroke for all my comrades' grief, all you killed in the fury of your spear." With that, shaft poise, he hurled, and his spear's long shadow flew. But seeing it coming, glorious Hector ducked away, crouching down, watching the bronze tip fly past and stab the earth. But Athena snatched it up and passed it back to Achilles. And Hector, the gallant captain, never saw her. He sounded out a challenge to Peleus' princely son. "You missed! Look! The great godlike Achilles! So you knew nothing at all from Zeus about my death, and yet how sure you were, all bluff. Cunning with words, that's all you are, trying to make me fear you, lose my nerve, forget my fighting strength. Well, you'll never plant your lance in my back as I flee you in fear. Plunge it through my chest as I come charging in, if A god gives you the chance, but now it's for you to dodge my brazen spear. I wish you'd bury it in your body to the hilt. How much lighter the war would be for Trojans then if you, their greatest scourge, were dead and gone. Shaft poised, he hurled, and his spear's long shadow flew, and it struck Achilles' shield. A dead center hit, but often away it glanced, and Hector seethed. His hurtling spear, his whole arm's power poured in a wasted shot. He stood there, cast down. He had no spear in reserve. So Hector shouted out to Deiphobus, bearing his white shield. With a ringing shout, he called for the heavy lance. But the man was nowhere near him. Vanished. Yes. And Hector knew the truth in his heart. And the fighter cried aloud, "My time has come. At last the gods have called me down to death. I thought he was at my side, the hero, Deiphobus. He's safe inside the walls. Athena's tricked me blind, and now death. Grim death is looming up beside me, no longer far away. No way to escape it now. This was their pleasure, after all, sealed long ago. Zeus and the son of Zeus, the distant deadly archer. Though often before now they rushed to my defense, so now I meet my doom. Well, let me die, but not without struggle, no. Not without glory. In some great clash of arms that even men to come will hear of down the years." And on that resolve, he drew the whetted sword that hung at his side, tempered, massive, and gathering all his force, he swooped like a soaring eagle launching down from the dark clouds to earth to snatch some helpless lamb or trembling hare. So Hector swooped now, swinging his whetted sword. And Achilles charged too, bursting with rage, barbaric, guarding his chest with the well-wrought blazoned shield, head tossing his gleaming helmet, four horns strong, and the golden plume shook that the god of fire drove in bristling thick along its ridge. Bright as that star amid the stars in the night sky, star of the evening, brightest star that rides the heavens, so fire flared from the sharp point of the spear Achilles brandished high in his right hand, bent on Hector's death, scanning his splendid body. Where to pierce it best? The rest of his flesh seemed all encased in armor, burnished, brazen. Achilles' armor that Hector stripped from strong Patroclus when he killed him. True, but one spot lay exposed. Where collarbone lift the neck bone off the shoulder. The open throat, where the end of life comes quickest. There. As Hector charged in fury brilliant, Achilles drove his spear, and the point went stabbing clean through the tender neck. But the heavy bronze weapon failed to slash the windpipe. Hector could still gasp out some words, some last reply. He crashed in the dust. Godlike Achilles gloried over him. "Hector! Surely you thought when you stripped Patroclus' armor that you would be safe. Never a fear of me, far from the fighting as I was. You fool. Left behind there down by the beaked ships, his great avenger waited, a greater man by far. That man was I, and I smashed your strength, and you, the dogs and birds, will maul you. Shame your corpse, while Achaeans bury my dear friend in glory." Struggling for breath, Hector, his helmet flashing, said, "I beg of you, beg by your life, your parents. Don't let the dogs devour me by the Argive ships. Wait. Take the princely ransom of bronze and gold, the gifts my father and noble mother will give you. But give my body to friends to carry home again, so Trojan men and Trojan women can do me honor with fitting rites of fire once I am dead. Staring grimly, the proud runner Achilles answered, "Beg no more, you fawning dog. Begging me by my parents? Would to God my rage, my fury would drive me now to hack your flesh away and eat you raw. Such agonies you have caused me. Ransom! No man alive can keep the dog packs off you, not if they haul in 10, 20 times that ransom and pile it here before me and promise fortunes more. No, not even if Dardan Priam should offer to weigh out your bulk in gold. Not even then will your noble mother lay you on your deathbed, mourn the son she bore. The dogs and birds will rend you, blood and bone." At the point of death, Hector, his helmet flashing, said, "I know you well. I see my fate before me. Never a chance that I could win you over. Iron inside your chest, that heart of yours. But now beware, or my curse will draw God's wrath upon your head that day when Paris and Lord Apollo, for all your fighting heart, destroy you at the Scaean gates." Death cut him short. The end closed in around him, flying free of his limbs, his soul went winging down to the house of death, wailing his fate, leaving his manhood far behind, his young and supple strength. But brilliant Achilles taunted Hector's body, dead as he was, "Die! Die! For my own death, I'll meet it freely, whenever Zeus and the other deathless gods would like to bring it on." With that, he wrenched his bronze spear from the corpse, laid it aside, and ripped the bloody armor off the back. And the other sons of Achaea, running up around him, crowded closer, all of them gazing wonderstruck at the build and marvelous lithe beauty of Hector, and not a man came forward who did not stab his body. Glancing toward a comrade, laughing, "Ha! Look here! How much softer he is to handle now, this Hector, than when he gutted our ships with roaring fire." Standing over him so, they'd gloat and stab his body. But once he had stripped the corpse, the proud runner Achilles took his stand in the midst of all the Argive troops and urged them on with a flight of winging orders. "Friends, lords of the Argives, oh my captains, now that the gods have let me kill this man who caused us agonies, loss on crushing loss, more than the rest of all their men combined, come, let us ring their walls in armor, test them, see what recourse the Trojans still may have in mind. Will they abandon the city heights with this man fallen, or brace for a last standing, a dying stand, though Hector's gone? But wait. What am I saying? Why this deep debate? Down by the ships, a body lies unwept, unburied. Patroclus. I will never forget him. Not as long as I'm still among the living and my springing knees will lift and drive me on. Though the dead forget their dead in the house of death, I will remember even there, my dear companion. Now come, You sons of Achaea, raise a song of triumph. Down to the ships we march and bear this corpse on high. We have won ourselves great glory. We have brought magnificent Hector down. That man the Trojans glorified in their city like a god. So he triumphed. And now he was bent on outrage, on shaming noble Hector. Piercing the tendons, ankle to heel behind both feet, he knotted straps of rawhide through them both, lashed them to his chariot, left the head to drag, and mounting the car, hoisting the famous arms aboard, he whipped his team to a run, and breakneck on they flew, holding nothing back, and a thick cloud of dust rose up from the man they dragged, his dark hair swirling round, that head so handsome once, all tumbled low in the dust, since Zeus had given him over to his enemies now, to be defiled in the land of his own fathers. So, his whole head was dragged down in the dust. And now, his mother began to tear her hair. She flung her shining veil to the ground and raised a high, shattering scream, looking down at her son. Pitifully, his loving father groaned, and round the king his people cried with grief, and wailing seized the city for all the world as if all Troy were torched and smoldering down from the looming brows of the citadel to her roots. Priam's people could hardly hold the old man back, frantic, mad to go rushing out to the Dardan gates. He begged them all, groveling in the filth, crying out to them, calling each man by name, "Let go, my friends, much as you care for me, let me hurry out of the city, make my way all on my own to Achaea's waiting ships. I must implore that terrible, violent man, perhaps. Who knows? He may respect my age, may pity an old man. He has a father, too, as old as I am. Peleus sired him once. Peleus reared him to be the scourge of Troy, but most of all to me. He made my life a hell. So many sons he slaughtered, just coming into bloom, but grieving for all the rest, one breaks my heart the most, and stabbing grief for him will take me down to death. My Hector, would to God he had perished in my arms. Then his mother who bore him, oh, so doomed, she and I could glut ourselves with grief." So the voice of the king rang out in tears. The citizens wailed in answer, and noble Hecuba led the wives of Troy in a throbbing chant of sorrow. "Oh, my child, my desolation, how can I go on living? What agonies must I suffer now? Now you are dead and gone. You were my pride throughout the city, night and day, a blessing to us all, the men and women of Troy. Throughout the city, they saluted you like a god. You were their greatest glory while you lived. Now death and fate have seized you, dragged you down." Her voice rang out in tears. But the wife of Hector had not heard a thing. No messenger brought the truth of how her husband made his stand outside the gates. She was weaving at her loom, deep in the high halls, working flowering braiding into a dark red folding robe. And she called her well-kempt women through the house to set a large three-legged cauldron over the fire so Hector could have his steaming hot bath when he came home from battle. Poor woman. She never dreamed how far he was from bathing. Struck down at Achilles' hands by blazing-eyed Athena. But she heard the groans and wails of grief from the rampart now, and her body shook, her shuttle dropped to the ground. She called out to her lovely waiting women, "Quickly, two of you follow me.
I must see what's happened. That cry, that was Hector's honored mother I heard. My heart's pounding, leaping up in my throat, the knees beneath me paralyzed. Oh, I know it. Something terrible's coming down on Priam's children. Pray God the news will never reach my ears. Yes, but I dread it so. What if great Achilles has cut my Hector off from the city, daring Hector, and driven him out across the plain, and all alone? He may have put an end to that fatal headstrong pride that always seized my Hector, never hanging back with the main force of men, always charging ahead, giving ground to no man in his fury. So she cried, dashing out of the royal halls like a madwoman, her heart racing hard, her women close behind her. But once she reached the tower where soldiers massed, she stopped on the rampart, looked down, and saw it all. Saw him dragged before the city, stallions galloping, dragging Hector back to Achaea's beaked warships. Ruthless work. The world went black as night before her eyes. She fainted, falling backward, gasping away her life breath. She flung to the winds her glittering headdress, the cap, the coronet, braided band and veil, all the regalia golden Aphrodite gave her once, the day that Hector, helmet aflash in sunlight, led her home to Troy from her father's house with countless wedding gifts to win her heart. But crowding round her now, her husband's sisters and brothers' wives supported her in their midst. And she, terrified, stunned, to the point of death, struggling for breath now and coming back to life, burst out in grief among the Trojan women. Oh, Hector, I am destroyed. Both born to the same fate after all. You at Troy in the halls of King Priam, I at Thebes, under the timberline of Placos, Eetion's house. He raised me as a child, that man of doom, his daughters just as doomed. Would to God he'd never fathered me. Now you go down to the house of death, the dark depths of the earth, and leave me here to waste away in grief, a widow lost in the royal halls, and the boy only a baby. The son we bore together, you and I so doomed. Hector, what help are you to him now you are dead? What help is he to you? Think, even if he escapes the wrenching horrors of war against the Argives, pain and labor will plague him all his days to come. Strangers will mark his lands off, stealing his estates. The day that orphans a youngster cuts him off from friends, and he hangs his head low, humiliated in every way, his cheeks stained with tears. And pressed by hunger, the boy goes up to his father's old companions, tugging at one man's cloak, another's tunic, and some will pity him, true, and one will give him a little cup to drink, enough to wet his lips, not quench his thirst. But then some bully, with both his parents living, beats him from the banquet, fists and abuses flying. You! Get out. You've got no father feasting with us here. And the boy, sobbing, trails home to his widowed mother. Astyanax! And years ago, propped on his father's knee, he would eat only the marrow, the richest cuts of lamb. And when sleep came on him and he had quit his play, cradled warm in his nurse's arms, he'd drowse off, snug in a soft bed, his heart brimmed with joy. Now, what suffering. Now he's lost his father. Astyanax, the lord of the city. So the Trojans called him because it was you, Hector, you and you alone, who shielded the gates and the long walls of Troy. But now, by the beaked ships far from your parents, glistening worms will wriggle through your flesh. Once the dogs have had their fill of your naked corpse.
though we have such stores of clothing laid up in the halls. Fine things, a joy to the eye, the work of women's hands. Now, by God, I'll burn them all, blazing to the skies. No use to you now. They'll never shroud your body, but they will be your glory, burned by the Trojan men and women in your honor. Her voice rang out in tears, and the women wailed in answer.
Stephen Lang reading from Homer's Iliad, The Death of Hector, in the translation by the late Robert Fagles. After a break, we'll be back with Felicia Rashad reading the love story of Paolo and Francesca from Dante's Inferno. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Our next epic author, Dante Alighieri, was at least a couple of thousand years younger than Homer, living from 1265 until 1321. The Florentine poet's great epic, The Divine Comedy, is a journey in three parts: Hell, or the Inferno, Purgatorio, and finally Paradiso. In the Inferno, Dante is guided on his tour of Hell by the Roman epic poet Virgil, who takes him through the successive circles of hell. We will hear cantos 4 and 5, culminating in the traveler's encounter with the tragic lovers Paolo and Francesca. The reader is the actress and director Felicia Rashad. Here she is now to read from Dante's Inferno.
A heavy crack of thunder broke upon the deepest currents of my sleep, so that suddenly I woke as if by force, and with a drowsy gaze, looked about, then stood to get a better sense of where I was, and found myself at the edge of a steep rise that dropped into an abyss of pain, a veil of endless cries, so clogged with murky air, so dark that though I strained to see into its depths, I saw nothing there. "Let's descend to that blind world below," began the poet, his face like ash. "I'll go first, and you can follow." But when I saw how scared, how pale he was, I said, "How can I count on you to help me if I should fail?" And he said to me, "It's the people here, their misery that paints my face with the pity you mistake for fear. Come, a long way lies ahead of us." He entered and had me enter too the first circle surrounding the abyss. There was no howling that I could hear, nothing but sighs that rose to shake the everlasting air. Sighs of painless woe from milling crowds of men and women and children who would never know relief. Then the good master said, "Don't you care whose souls these are you see? Before we travel anywhere, know they have not sinned, that all their good was not enough. Baptism alone is the gate to the faith you hold, and if they lived before the days of Christianity, They did not truly worship God. I am one of these. For this fault only, and no other crime, we are lost. And our punishment is to live without hope until the end of time, yet with desire. On hearing this, a sadness filled my heart for all the noble souls who now in limbo dwelt. Tell me, Master, tell me, I began, wanting to be sure of the faith that overcomes all wrongs. Has anyone ever left this place on his own merits or on another's who later on was blessed? And he, able to guess my meaning, answered, I was new here when I saw a mighty lord wearing a crown of victory. He led away our first father's shade and his son Abel's and Noah's and that of trusting Moses who made the laws and patriarchal Abraham and David the king in Israel with his father and children and Rachel who resisted him and many others. And he blessed them all. And you should know that before these, not a human soul had yet been saved. We did not stop, but walked with ease the while he spoke, passing through woods, woods that is, of souls that stood like trees. We still had not gone far from where I woke when I saw a fire in front of us, a glowing hemisphere that lit the dark. And while we were still a short ways off, but close enough to tell, worthy people gathered there. Oh, you who honor science and art, who are these whose virtue is so great that from others they are kept apart? And he to me, each holds a place of honor in your world which favors them down here by heaven's grace. And while he spoke, another voice broke. Hail, the greatest of poets, his shade that left is back with us again. And when the voice was still, I saw four mighty shades come toward us, looking neither sad nor joyful. The one with sword in hand, my master started to explain, the one leading the other three and in command is Homer, the undisputed king of poets. And next is Horace, the satirist. Ovid is third, with Lucan following. Since they share with me a calling, the one just uttered by that voice, they do me honor. And honor what we do. So, before me stood that brilliant school led by the maker of the greatest poem, who soars above the others like an eagle. After they talked among themselves a while, they turned and welcomed me. At this, I saw my master smile. They showed me even greater honor when they welcomed me as one of them, making me sixth among the wise. And so we went together toward the light, talking of things best not spoken of again, as speaking of them once was right. Then we arrived at the foot of a noble castle surrounded seven times by lofty walls and guarded by a lovely moat, which we crossed as if on solid ground. Then we went through seven gates into a fresh meadow where we found people with grave, slow-moving eyes who bore the look of great authority, who seldom spoke and did not let their voices rise. Then we moved to one side of a wide lawn, high and light-filled, from which those who gathered there could be gazed upon. There before me, on that shining green, the great spirits were pointed out, and in my heart I felt the glory of the scene. I saw Electra standing with a group among whom I saw Hector and Aeneas and hawk-eyed Caesar dressed for war. I saw Camilla and Penthesilea, and seated across the lawn, I saw King Latinus with Lavinia, his daughter. I saw Brutus, who drove away the Tarquin, Lucretia, Julia, Marcia, and Cornelia, and standing by himself, saw Saladin. When I raised my eyes a little higher, I saw the master of those who know sitting with his philosophic family who look his way and pay him honor. There, nearest him and before the rest, I saw Socrates and Plato and Democritus, who says we're ruled by randomness. Diogenes, Anaxagoras, Thales, Empedocles, Zeno, and Heraclitus. I saw Dioscorides, the great taxonomist of plants. I saw Orpheus, Tully, and Linus, and Seneca, the moralist, Euclid, the geometer, and Ptolemy, Hippocrates, Galen, Avicenna, and Averroes, who made the commentary. I cannot stop to describe them all in full, for I am driven forward by my theme, and there's always more than I can say. The company of six shrinks only to two. My knowing guide leads me away out of the quiet into the trembling air, and I come to a place where nothing shines. Then I went down through the first circle into the second, which encircles less space, but a suffering so great it raises a chorus of weeping. And that's where Minos stands, smiling grotesquely at the entrance, where he looks over the souls, judges, and sends them on, coiling his tail. I mean to say, when the unfortunate soul appears before him, it confesses everything, and he, a connoisseur of mortal sins, knows exactly where each soul belongs in hell. He coils himself with his tail once for each of the levels down which that soul must descend. There's always a crowd of them before him, and each, when its time comes, receives judgment. They speak, hear their fate, and are cast below. "You who arrive in this house of pain," cried Minos when his eyes discovered me interrupting the work of his important office, "be cautious as you enter and whom you trust. Don't be fooled by the gate's easy entrance." And my guide replied, "Must you too call out? Don't get in the way of what's destined here. A journey willed from above by the one whose desires aren't questioned. Ask no more." And now I begin to hear notes of misery. I find myself where a surfeit of weeping beats on me. I came to a place of muted light, a place roaring like the sea, pitched in a storm, torn apart by clashing winds. The nightmarish, never-ending hurricane drives the spirits before it with a vengeance, whirling and punishing and tormenting them. When they confront the storm-ripped landscape, there are cries, weeping, and lamentations, and it's there they curse God himself. I learned this was the cruel punishment of the carnal sinners, those who abandon reason for desire. And as starlings carry through winter air on wings and flocks crowded and wide,
The wind bears the wicked spirits here, there, up, down, driving them everywhere. There's no hope, nothing to console them, no chance of rest, much less of easing their pain. And just as cranes fly, chanting their cries from extended formations of themselves, so the shades approached, wailing, keening, carried on that chaos of battling winds. I ask, Master, who are these souls punished in the lash of this black air? The first one whose story you wish to know, he said, hearing my question, was an empress who ruled a population of different tongues. Such was her taste for promiscuity, she passed laws condoning lust to justify her own scandal. She is Semiramis, who, as we've read, was the wife of Ninus and succeeded him and so ruled the land the Sultan now rules. The spirit who came next killed herself for love and betrayed the ashes of Sychaeus. Next comes Cleopatra, driven by lust, and Helen, responsible for years of savage war. And there's Achilles himself, who in his final battle lost to love. See Paris and Tristan? He pointed out more than 1,000 shades, naming each who for love alone was taken from the living. And as I heard my teacher name the ladies and knights of another era, pity gripped me and set my mind adrift. Poet, I said to him, I'd be happy to talk to those two who approached together, carried almost weightless on the wind. And he said to me, you'll see when they get closer to us. Then you can appeal to them by the love that bears them on, and they'll come to you. At that moment, the wind swept them near us, and I called out, weary souls, come talk with us, unless there's someone who forbids it. And just as doves called down by desire return with their wings poised and balanced through the air, willed back to their sweet nests, those two abandoned Dido's group, moving toward us through the malignant air, so convincing was my tender call to them. Oh, living creature, gracious and kind. You have traveled here through this murky air to visit us who stained the world with blood. If he who rules the universe were a friend, we'd beg him to grant you peace because you've pitied our depraved state. Whatever you wish to hear, we'll tell you. If you want to talk, we'll listen for as long as it's windless here. I was born in a town set on the shores where the Po and its tributaries converge, where their waters finally rest. Love, which quickly ignites the tender heart, seized his heart with the beauty of my body. A beauty torn from me in an act that torments me still. Love, which pardons no one who's loved from loving, took hold of me with a passion so strong it hasn't faded, as you can see for yourself. Love guided us to a single death, but Cana awaits the one who took our lives. This was the speech they delivered to us. What I heard from these wounded souls bent down my head, and I kept it lowered until the poet asked, what are you thinking? I answered him, alas, how many sweet thoughts. What great longing carried them to such a pathetic end? Then I turned back to the lovers and said,
Francesca, everything you've suffered torments me with grief and pity, but tell me, during those days of sweet sighs, how did love make it possible for you to sense your sleeping passion? And she said to me, there's no greater pain than remembering joy in a time of sorrow, as your teacher well knows. However, if you really want to hear the story of how our love took hold, I'll tell you, weeping as I talk. One day, with nothing better to do, we read of Lancelot, how he fell prey to love. We were alone, but suspected nothing. As we read, it happened our eyes would meet, draining the warm color from our faces. But it was a single passage that released us. When we read how the long-pursued smile was kissed by so accomplished a lover, this man, who will be with me forever, kissed my mouth, his body trembling in the kiss. Both the book and author are Gellerholt. And so our reading ended for that day. As she shared her story with us, the other spirit wept. Pity struck me and I fainted as if departing this life. And down I went as a dead body falls.
Felicia Rashad read cantos 4 and 5 from Dante Alighieri's The Inferno in English versions by Mark Strand and Daniel Halpern. Our third and final epic tale on this broadcast, Paul West's Captain Ahab, a novel by the White Whale, is not Herman Melville's Moby Dick, but rather it is a very short one-page meditation on that epic novel. Here is his White Whale, in the voice of the wonderful actress Diane Venora, telling its own version of the epic tale.
I, too, alone survive to tell thee. A whale tells this, white as Biscay froth, a tale black as caviar. I almost lost heart. Albinos do, doomed special, while feeling like the rest. We're dark unto ourselves. We? I am the only one. I have never bred. I have never seen a white male or a white mate. I never had company save for him. Only during brief heaven, a mother who nudged and nourished. Shunned, I go from ocean to ocean, falling in love with icebergs and fluffy fog, and nearer shore with snow and polar bears. I am forbidden nothing, but there is nothing I can have. What sex am I? Did Ahab know? Squinting aft, I see him, rib cage and all, As the years went by, he began to rattle. Then to chime. I read his last will and testament from his lips. Then took him down for the count. Poor piscuniac of a mariner. Then I whale hummed at him, just to be friendly. I wanted somehow to swing him loose, then pop him down, minnow frail, feathers small. Install him on the bubbly mound of one vast kidney according to Jonah Law. A pet, a familiar, a love. But dislodge him I could not, and I soon knew his coming for what it was, a test in the form of a sign, a sign in the form of a test. Could I brook his presence without wanting friendship? Ahab was my birthmark. Yes. Ishmael, art thou sleeping there below? Then answer would come. Moby, I am thine forever. Ah, it was all hopeless. Call me, I began. But my still thundering jelly of a heart floated upward through my mouth, jump a thump. And all that's left is an unfolded compass rose miming its thanks, murmuring a tune.
Diane Venora read Paul West's Captain Ahab, a novel by the White Whale. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.